Or he. Damn, it's hard to write a book and not get yelled at. I know you just started reading this book, so you are still getting to know me. And maybe you are questioning my commitment to these animals. You think I'm writing a fanciful flight about these odd and amusing creatures. But I am 100% genuine in my devotion to them. Where does my obsession with them end? Not in a disgusting New York City garbage can, where I once made a boyfriend rescue them after we discovered the movers had made a terrible mistake and thrown them all away. To be fair to the movers, Pokey does look like she belongs in a dark alley in a war-torn village and not in a nice, grown-ass woman's bedroom. You might be thinking of asking me, Amy, did you commission Tilda Swinton's life partner, Sandro, to paint a portrait of your stuffed animals to commemorate them forever and ever? No. That would be taking it too far. Oh, wait, no. I mean, fuck yes, I did that. They're worth it. Each one of them is a ratty, pilled pile of fabric sewn together precariously, but I love them more than most of my family. Dad. When I was 14, my dad shit himself at an amusement park. It all went down one fine summer morning when he took Kim and me to Adventureland, which is exactly what it sounds like. An amusement park filled with adventure. As long as you've never been on an actual adventure, or to an actual amusement park. I'd fantasized about the trip the whole week, dreaming about my two favorite rides, the pirate ship and the swings. Granted, they were two of the tamer rides at the park, but for me, they were at the absolute outer limit of my comfort zone. I liked the rides that gave you that feeling of weightlessness that shot from your stomach right down to your vagina when the ride dropped. But I'd never enjoyed a ride that went upside down or spun around until I puked, and I still don't. I guess you could say I have a low tolerance for fear in general. The movie Clue terrified me beyond belief as a child. I slept with a pillow on my back because the chef in that movie was stabbed in the back with a huge kitchen knife. Not gonna happen to this gal. Just try to get a knife through this pillow, I thought. As if a murderer would enter my bedroom at night, intent on stabbing me in the back, see that pillow was there, and cancel his plans. I used a similar tactic after hearing about, but not seeing, the movie Misery. I slept with pillows covering my legs in case Kathy Bates got a late-night urge to drive out to Long Island, break into my home, and beat my legs with a mallet. Maybe this is why I always slept with, still sleep with, all my scary-looking horror show stuffed animals. For protection. Suffice it to say, I was a major scaredy cat. In fourth grade, I had a talk with the school psychologist about all the things that actively terrified me. I wasn't sent to see him by a concerned teacher. I actually asked to see him. I was probably the only 9-year-old in history who requested time with a shrink. After our session, he handed my mom a list of all my fears. This list included earthquakes and tapeworms, which didn't usually come up where I lived, but my brother was learning about them in school, and he couldn't resist the urge to convince me I was nothing more than a sitting duck who was 100% going to get eaten alive from the inside by a worm. Highest and most memorable on the list, however, was the specific fear that I'd accidentally churn myself into butter. This was inspired by a creepy antique children's book called Little Black Sambo, which is one of those stories from the simpler, more racist times of yore when people wrote frightening, insulting tales to help children fall asleep at night. It was highly popular back in the day and has since been rightly banned or taken out of circulation. But my mom had a copy lying around. It's about a boy who goes on an adventure and ends up getting chased by tigers who circle and circle around a tree so fast that they churn themselves into a pool of butter, which the boy then takes home for his mother to use to make pancakes. Like you do! Anyway, I was always riddled with fear that I'd somehow be transformed into melted butter, which now doesn't really sound like that much of a bummer. It sounds more like how I'd like to spend my last 24 hours on Earth. Anyhoozle. The morning my dad was going to take us to Adventureland, I woke up and got dressed in denim shorts that stopped just above the knee, crazy flattering, and a long t-shirt with the Tasmanian devil on it, to let people know what was up. The shirt had to be knotted at the side, because it was the early 90s, and that's how you rocked out then. It was not usual for my dad to take us on fun outings, but our parents had recently divorced, so we'd started spending solo time with him. This way, we could sneak in some fun, and he could sneak in feeling like a parent. He picked us up in his little red convertible around 10 a.m. Even after he lost everything, he still always drove a convertible. I sat in the front because the back was too windy, and I convinced Kim that she'd like it better. It was about a 40-minute drive from our house, but it felt like 400 because of the anticipation. The dozen or so rides, the limitless sour powers, and the arcade games just inside the park. My dad always made me feel super loved and did the best he possibly could. But when I was a kid, his identity confused me. He wasn't the golf-playing, beer-drinking family man I saw on TV or in my friends' kitchens. He wasn't so easily labeled, or so easily understood. When he was younger, he'd been a wealthy bachelor living in 1970s New York City, when it was also in its prime. He'd shared a penthouse with his best friend Josh, who was a well-known actor at the time. He did drugs and slept with girls and enjoyed every moment of his life. When he met my mom, he said goodbye to that lifestyle. Kind of. Throughout my childhood, he was always in shape, tanned and well-dressed. He was an international businessman, frequently traveling to France, Italy, Prague, and I'd know he'd return home from a trip before I saw or heard him, as his smell was so potent and gorgeous. I thought it was a mixture of expensive European cologne, a faint smell of cigarettes, and something else I didn't yet recognize, but later discovered was alcohol. I never knew my dad to be a big drinker. I never saw him and thought he was even a little buzzed. If you don't know the signs, then they can't be there. I remember coming home from school and seeing him passed out naked on the floor, but not putting two and two together. I remember that he once apologized to me for missing a volleyball game that he was at, but I just thought, oh, forgetful dad. I knew he smelled like scotch, but I thought nothing of it. To this day, when a guy I'm with is really hungover or drunk, the smell reminds me of my dad. As I warmly cuddle him closer, when I tell the guy, he laughs, thinking I'm joking. I only found out later that my dad was as serious an alcoholic as they came. He needed to go to detox several times when we were children. To his credit, he was clever with his addiction. He only drank when he traveled, or when we slept. So, all the time, and every night. The only thing that slowed down his drinking was multiple sclerosis. He was diagnosed when I was about 10, and was soon in the hospital for a while, since the disease hit like a tidal wave. It started with a tingle in his feet and fingers, and grew to complete numbness and pain in his legs. When he finally got out of the hospital, he kind of went back to normal. I didn't think about his illness, and no one brought it up again. I loved my dad, but like any self-obsessed teen, I wasn't worried with his mortality. Even though I saw him lying in the hospital bed in pain, I still thought of him as invincible. The morning he picked us up to go to Adventureland, I had pirate ship rides on the brain and can't say I was too concerned about his health. When we pulled up to the gates of the park, we ran to the high-flying swings and got in line. It was a little chilly, so it wasn't too busy, which meant that we got to go on the ride two or three times in a row before moving on. I loved those swings, because I could pretend I was fearless and twist my chair around and around before they shot up in the air to begin the ride, spinning me high in the sky. I wanted to beeline to the pirate ship, but Kim wanted to go on the big, scary roller coaster. We had all day, so I said fine, even though roller coasters brought me zero joy. Being jolted around and the yelling and the possibility of dying didn't and still doesn't do it for me. I hated creeping up the hill at a painfully slow pace, only to shoot down and hear the screams of all the people filled with regret for coming aboard. But Kim liked them, and I liked Kim. And since I was the big sister, I wanted her to always think I was brave, so I pretended it was no big deal and got in line. But to be honest, I also wanted to wow my dad. He knew I was a complete chicken shit, and I thought he might notice and say something like, "Hey, Amy, your going on that ride was very cool and interesting." He loved things like skydiving, which I eventually did when I was older, also to try and impress him, even though I hated every single second of it. So there we stood in a long line that felt like it was moving too fast. I hunched over a bit, hoping I wouldn't meet the height requirement for the ride, but no such luck. I continued to hope that the roller coaster would close down for the day right before we got up to the front, or that there would be a lockdown on the park for a missing kid. There were thousands of kids there. Couldn't just one of them get lost? But alas, no. We were next. "Do you want to sit in the front car?" the 6-year-old-looking kid operating the ride asked us. "Yes!" Kim yelled. I looked at my dad, who was giving me a most likely sarcastic thumbs up. "Yeah," I added, even though Kim had already hopped in the front. "I'll be watching you girls," he said ecstatically. We waved to my dad as we started creeping up Suicide Mountain, or whatever the roller coaster was called. I don't remember much of the next 2 minutes, but finally the car stopped and I opened my eyes. The only silver lining was that I didn't get physically hurt, and it was a great way to practice dissociating, something my siblings and I all perfected by our early teen years. We climbed off, and Kim was thrilled. She'd had the time of her life. I can't speak for the other maniacs on that ride, but for me, the roller coaster was traumatic. When I walked down that ramp, I felt as though the president should have been at the bottom waiting to give me a medal for valor. But there was no medal, just my dad, smiling at us. "There's no line," Kim shouted. "Let's go again." And so we went, and we went, and we went. Each time, my dad cheered us on from the bottom. We must have ridden that thing 5 times when we reached the end of the ride, and he wasn't there. "Where's Dad?" Kim asked. I told her he's probably getting us candy or something. While we waited for him, we rode the ride again, and again, and again. After the 12th go, I was feeling real ready to get on that pirate ship, which was the main adventure I wanted to have in this land. Kim was raring to go again, but I had to stop. I thought it might be nice to take a break and maybe have kids someday, and I was sure Dad would meet us when he was done doing... What was he doing? At that point in time, I hadn't yet realized how funny my dad is. Most of the things he did or said flew right over my head, and everyone else's for that matter. His sense of humor was so dry that days would pass before people realized he'd insulted them. He threw out perfect one-liners under his breath while talking to waiters or bankers or my mom, and no one heard them but me. Once my grandma was talking to him, and she said, "If I die," and he corrected her slyly, "When?" He was even dark with us as children. I remember walking into the kitchen one time and seeing him pretending that I had just caught him in the act of putting our dog, Muffin, in the microwave. He had a way about him that made it seem like nothing could ruffle his feathers or surprise him. So that day, while Kim and I sat on a bench and waited for my father, I saw a new side of him. We waited and waited. I put stupid braids in Kim's hair and made her give me a hand massage until he finally reappeared. When he walked up to us, the first thing I noticed was his expression. He was panicked and defeated at the same time. The second thing I noticed was that he didn't have pants on. Kim didn't observe any of this because she immediately asked, "Can we get fudge?" "Sure," my dad answered. He and I looked at each other. I was speechless. His t-shirt, which was soaking wet along the bottom half, was long enough to cover his underwear, but his pants were long gone. "We need to go, Aim," he told me very calmly. I thought about asking something reasonable, like, "Where are your pants, Dad?" But he looked in my eyes and communicated that I shouldn't ask any questions. I went to the country store-themed shop and got Kim her fudge. And then we all walked briskly to the car. I didn't look to see if anyone was staring. I only watched 10-year-old Kim, who was fully enthralled by every bite of her treat. Does she really not see that he's pantsless? I know it's called Adventureland, but I don't think those adventures involve men over 40 dressing like Winnie the Pooh after a wet t-shirt contest. We'd just gotten very close to the car when a breeze hit and sent the smell my way. It was shit. Human shit. It was then I realized, oh, my dad shit his pants. Okay. I quickly leveraged this opportunity to look like a selfless and charitable sister. "You can get shotgun this time, Kimmy." I was quick on my feet. "Really?" she answered. She was so excited to get this privilege that it kind of broke my heart. Amusement park fudge and shotgun? She couldn't believe her luck. Little did she know she wouldn't be able to enjoy eating that fudge for much longer, or possibly ever again. We climbed in the car, me in the back, Kim up front with my dad. As he put down the top, I looked in the side mirror and saw Kim's nostrils start to flare. She'd picked up the scent. The most silent car ride of my life began. The fudge sat in Kim's lap for the rest of the ride, and her head slowly crept further and further in the direction away from my dad. The entire top was down on the car, but she still felt the need to hang her little head out the side. She looked like a golden retriever by the time my dad pulled up to our house to drop us off. I was so impressed with her for not saying anything. What a good girl, I thought. She kissed my dad on the cheek and thanked him and ran into the house. Her face, the same exact hue as Kermit the Frog. I hopped out and held my breath to kiss him. I started to walk up our driveway when he called to me. "Aim." I turned and answered, "Yeah?" He took a breath and said, "Please don't tell your mom." I nodded. The saddest realization I've had in my life is that my parents are people. Sad human people. I aged a decade in that moment. The second time my dad shit himself in my presence, I didn't have a roller coaster to keep me from witnessing it. It was right in front of me. Well, more to the side of me. It was 4 years later, the summer before I left for college, right before I got on a plane to Montana to stay with my older brother Jason for a couple weeks. I worshipped Jason and was always trying to hang out with him. He is almost 4 years older than me, and as far as I was concerned, he should have won People magazine's Most Intriguing Person of the Year every year. He was a basketball prodigy in his early teens, but suddenly quit in high school because he didn't want to live up to other people's expectations anymore. He was curious about things like time and space and genuinely considered living in a cave for months and being nocturnal. He became an accomplished musician without telling anyone. He didn't go to his senior year of high school, choosing instead to earn the credits needed for graduation by driving cross-country and writing about it, somehow convincing the principal of our high school and our mother that this was a great idea. I know this is sounding like that Dos Equis ad that glorifies the eccentric old guy with a beard, but the point is I've been crazy about Jason since I was born, and I always wanted to be a part of whatever unusual existence he was living. So I went to hang out with him any chance I had. At this particular time, my dad was on a kick of wanting to do dad stuff for me. So he asked if he could drive me to the airport. When you have MS, dad stuff becomes playing bingo or giving you rides places. It was mid-afternoon when he picked me up to head to JFK. When we got there, I pulled my giant suitcase out of the trunk of his car and navigated the airport entrance without his help. This must have looked strange to other people, seeing this strapping man watch his 18-year-old daughter lift and tote her giant suitcase all by herself. But they didn't know he was sick. I didn't really understand the symptoms of the disease, but I did know that it slowed him down, that even if he looked normal, he could still be in a lot of pain, unable to do the small physical acts he used to do with ease. My dad accompanied me as I juggled my bags and checked in, and everything seemed fine. It was pre-9/11, so he could walk me to the gate, and that's exactly what he wanted to do. He kept saying, "I'm gonna walk you to the gate." I think it was a big deal for him, because he never did stuff like that for me. That was a mom-type job, but I was glad for his company. Because even though my list of fears had definitely gotten smaller by this point in my life, I was still pretty terrified of flying. We both went through security, shoes on, the good old days, and started walking down the long hall to my gate. That particular terminal was under heavy construction at the time, so we had to be careful where we walked. We still had a good ways to go when my dad took a sharp right turn and beelined it to the side of the hall. I stopped walking and turned to see what he was doing. He shot me a pained look, pulled his pants down, and peed shit out of his ass for about 30 seconds. 30 seconds is an eternity, by the way, when you're watching your dad volcanically erupt from his behind. Think about it now. One Mississippi. That's just one. People quickly walked past, horrified. One woman shielded her child's eyes. They stared. I yelled at one chick passing by, "What? Keep it moving!" After he had finished, my dad stood up straight and said, "Aim, do you have any shorts in your bag?" I opened my suitcase and grabbed a pair of lacrosse shorts. I handed them over thinking, damn, those were my favorite. He threw his pants in the trash and put the shorts on. I went in for a top body hug goodbye. I didn't cry. I didn't laugh. I just smiled and said, "I love you, Dad. I won't tell Mom." I started to walk away from the whole scene when I heard, "I said I'd walk you to the gate." I turned around to see if he was joking. He was not. To the gate we walked. I was mouth-breathing and shooting dirty looks at anyone who dared to stare at him. Once we got to the very last gate in the goddamn terminal, at the end of a very long hall, he kissed me goodbye and left. Normally when I would board a plane, the first thing I would do was worry about how scary takeoff would be and try to think of ways to distract myself from the anxiety. But that day, I sat on the plane thinking about nothing. My mind went blank. It was too painful. I didn't think about my fearless father, who was dealing with a mysterious disease. He used to breeze through the airport in a cloud of expensive cologne and flashy watches, and now he'd been transformed into this anonymous, helpless guy who lost control of his bowels in the airport while his teenage daughter watched. He didn't wince or let me see him sweat even once. I mean, he was drenched in sweat. Physically, he was being taken over by MS. Yet on the inside, he was still as brazen as ever. But I didn't think about any of that. I just stared out the window for 5 hours, fully numb, until I got off the plane in Montana and hugged my brother longer than he would have liked. I tried to talk about these two shitting incidents on stage. So many parts of these stories are so disturbing that they make me laugh, because it's too much to digest any other way. The image of Kim's head leaning out of the car, the image of me standing next to my pantless father and the trolley that carted people around Adventureland. I look at the saddest things in life and laugh at how awful they are, because they are hilarious, and it's all we can do with moments that are painful. My dad is the same way. He always laughed at the things that are too dark for other people to laugh at. Even now, when his memory and mental functioning have been severely impaired by his MS, I'll tell him his mind is a pile of scrambled eggs, and he will still laugh hysterically and say, "Too true, too true." My dad never shows any sign that he pities himself. He never has. He's not afraid to look dead on at the grim facts of his life. I hope I've inherited this quality of his. I've only seen him cry once about his disease, and that was very recently when he learned he'd be getting stem cell treatments that would help him feel a lot better and maybe even help him walk again. That day, he sobbed like a baby, but never before. I have wonderful early memories of spending time with him at the beach. We were beach bums, and he was a sun worshiper. If it was January and the sun was shining, he'd douse himself in baby oil and sit outside in a lawn chair. He was tan year-round, and if it was summer, we'd get in the ocean early in the morning and get out after the sun went down. We'd body surf together. That was our thing. All I wanted to do was take a wave in further than him, but it never happened. I even cheated, standing up and running a little to catch up, but no, he always won. The most joy I remember feeling as a kid was when a storm was coming and the waves were big. Other people were scared and stayed out of the water, but not us. Not even when the ocean was angry and pulling us sideways. We would have to get out and walk half a football field on the beach before it swept us all the way down the shore again. We swam out against the current and caught the best waves of the day. Nothing kept us out. Not rain, not my mom yelling, nothing. I can still picture him looking young and healthy and strong with his bronze skin and his black hair soaking. For some reason, I wasn't afraid. Maybe it was because I was with him. Next to him, I was invincible. Excerpt from my journal in 1994, age 13, with footnotes from 2016. I've decided to get a journal because some things you just can't say out loud. Footnote. I obviously don't subscribe to this advice anymore, as someone who on stage has gone into great detail about an encounter with an unexpected uncircumcised penis. I'm 13 years old, and I have several problems. My brother Jason is a senior in high school. He's my half-brother, meaning we have the same mother, but his dad died when he was 11. When Jason was 2 years old, our mom married my dad. My dad didn't like my brother, and as a matter of fact, he wished Jason wasn't a part of our family. Footnote. Yikes! Was that true? There's a lot of heavy brainwashing from good old mom in this entry. I don't think my dad particularly cared for my brother, but it wasn't personal. He just only liked children that at one point were shot out from his own penis. I never noticed, but my dad actually never went on our family trips. Footnote. I don't know why family trips is in quotes. They were just family trips. This sounds like my mom was using us to mule drugs. We would go to Florida or Lake George or our farmhouse. I never once held a balloon filled with heroin. My mom just recently pointed all of this out to me. She said she tried to keep everyone happy by having my dad go in one car and me and my brother and sister go in the other car with her. Footnote. You know that old saying, the family that drives separately crumbles and shatters soon after? Jason's dad was a very big part of his life. My mom informed me that when he died, my dad made no effort to become Jason's stepfather. Footnote. This was true, but maybe pointing this out to a tween isn't the best move from a parent. They seemed to be acquaintances. This left my mom a single parent, basically with no help from my father. I'm so glad she pointed this out to me, because I never knew. She allowed Jason to withdraw from our family, which is no longer a family. Footnote. As I previously mentioned, Jason talked his way out of his senior year of high school and got to leave home and roam the country. My sister Kim is 9 years old and in fourth grade. She is very mature for her age. I think she's so mature because I don't permit her to act her age. In her grade, there are a few girls who are total beeps. Footnote. If I wrote this now, I would use the word cunts. They treat her like dirt. It doesn't help that Kim is extremely sensitive. These girls do horrible things to her. Like one day they were all sitting at the lunch table, and when Kim sat down, they all got up and left. When my mom told me about it, tears started streaming down my cheeks before she even finished her sentence. My heart broke for Kim. So I hopped on my bike and rode straight to those beeps' houses and yelled at them, and told them to leave my sister alone or else. Footnote.
Cunts!
Footnote. We recently Googled the girl who was the meanest to my sister. We found her on Facebook. She's now a yoga instructor, of course. And if I had her current address, I'd ride my bike to her house again and tell her she's still a worthless mean girl in my mind. Kim sometimes acts really phony. Footnote. Wow, I was just saying how great she was. She'll act so innocent and fragile, and I'll get really mad at her and treat her like crap. Footnote. Innocent and fragile? Dude, she was 9. What did I expect her to act like, slutty and hardened? My mom tells her to just express herself when someone at school hurts her feelings. I say, no way. You have to be tough and don't show them they hurt you. Footnote. I stand by this. Never let those cunts see you sweat. Which is good advice and a good name for an 80s hip-hop album. About 8 weeks ago, I found out that my parents were getting a divorce. Footnote. What? But mom kept us all happy by having us drive in separate cars. My dad travels a lot, so I wasn't majorly depressed. My sister was, though. After the first 5 years that my parents were married, my mom realized she wasn't in love and never had been. Footnote. Again, damn, mom, lot to lay on a kid who's still in middle school, but okay. But she stayed with my dad another 5 years because of me and Jay and Kim, and also because my dad developed a condition with osis at the end of the word. Footnote. It was multiple sclerosis. You couldn't look stuff up on your phone back then, so I just left it at osis. Makes sense. Anyone who knows my mom will tell you she's the nicest person you'll ever meet. Footnote. Brainwash. At the brainwash, yeah. I'm singing this to the tune of Car Wash. But they're getting a divorce. I'm going to see a psychologist this Thursday. I don't want to, but I know it's necessary. Footnote. I still say this exact same thing every single week. I have another problem. My friends Lauren, Becky, and Kate, I guess you can say we're the athletic, smart, pretty girls of our grade. Footnote. Guess I wasn't afraid of feeling myself. Becky is sort of slow. She has a moon-shaped face with light freckles and pin-straight, shoulder-length, dirty blonde hair. She's as tall as me, but a little slimmer. She thinks she's totally gorgeous and wishes she was Lauren. She's also a snob. Footnote. Never too young to talk shit about your friends. Then there's Jen. She's excellent at soccer and totally dedicated, but she's also a ditz, and always the last to know what we're talking about. She's 5'3"-ish and has mousy brown hair and looks very Irish. Everyone does, I guess. Footnote. Jen is a nurse with 3 kids now, and we're still close. I can't believe I haven't mentioned my other best friend, Mark. His hair is chin length and he's always showered and clean. He's a really good soccer player and he's an excellent drummer. I met him in 5th grade. He started a band this summer, and I was interested in being the lead singer. When it was just me and Mark in the band, I was fine. But when it became a real thing, I backed away. I strive to be more like Mark. Footnote. I was in love with him. I think I care too much about how people feel about me. Mark isn't like that at all. If I wasn't friends with him, I wouldn't be half as happy. Now that I think about it, he may be my only real friend. Footnote. Mark is now the drummer in the band Taking Back Sunday. Now about boys. Footnote. Sorry, Mark. There are several boys I like, but the two I'm concentrated on are Kevin Williams and Joshua Walsh. Kevin is shy, funny, and cool. He has shaggy brown hair and is over 6 feet tall. He has gorgeous blue cat eyes and a mouth like the Joker. I told him that once in biology, and he smirked and said he knew. Joshua is a year younger than me, but he's so sweet and adorable. He has black hair and a smaller frame than me, but he's strong and has porcelain skin covered in freckles. He looks like he just hopped off the boat from Ireland. Footnote. I was real obsessed with the Irish. Pretty sure I'd either just done a book report on them or watched Far and Away at a slumber party. Both boys have little speech impediments, I've noticed. Joshua has a speech impediment that makes him sound like the Kennedys, the real ones. Footnote. As opposed to those hack bullshit fake Kennedys? And Kevin has a gap in his front teeth and a lisp. Ugh, so cute. Footnote. I have always been turned on by a good impediment, like a baby arm or a stutter. I've gotten to first base, which is French kissing, but I think I'm ready for second. Footnote. I wasn't. Officially a woman. Everyone says you become a woman when you start your period, or lose your virginity. In Judaism, you're deemed a woman when you have your bat mitzvah. I, of course, saw this ceremony as an opportunity not only to chant my Torah portion, but also to make my big stage debut in the temple. I'd been doing musicals since I was 5, and I was ready to steal the show. I'm going to show these Jews what I'm made of, I thought, in an unracist way. All eyes were on me, just the way I liked it. As I looked out into the crowd from the Bima, my mom was crying tears of joy next to my dad, who was absolutely bursting with pride. I wouldn't have been surprised if they gave me a standing O before I finished. I was nailing it. I sang those Hebrew words like the little half-Jew angel that I was, without the slightest idea what I was saying. I could have been chanting a call to action to continue apartheid. In Hebrew school, they taught us two things, how to read Hebrew and how to read Hebrew. A year before my bat mitzvah, I was in class with my teacher, Mr. Fisher, a frightening expressionless man, the kind who would look the same sleeping or in an earthquake. I was sitting in the first row, and Mr. Fisher called on me to read aloud from the Torah. After about 3 minutes, I stopped and asked, "What does this mean?" For the first time ever, he showed emotion. He slammed his catcher's mitt-like hand onto his desk right next to my head and shouted, "Go to the principal's office!" I never asked again. I'm sure this wasn't the first time I got in trouble for asking a question, and it certainly wasn't the last. In school, we were encouraged to ask questions, but sometimes when we did, we were accused of being provocative or rude. Now that I'm out of school and there's no threat of a principal's office looming down the hall, I ask whatever the fuck questions I want. It feels pretty good. Pretty womanly, too. But none of that mattered on my big day. I didn't care what I was singing. I just wanted to blow everyone's socks off. I belted out the last couple lines of my portion. "Move over, cast a fiddler on the roof. Your jobs are all in jeopardy." And on my final note, I let loose with all my might. That was when my dream turned into my nightmare. My voice cracked. I William hunged my last note. My heart started to pound too quickly, and I could feel my face turning into a beat the way it loved to do. Silence filled the room, and I thought I might cry. Then came the first laugh, then another, and the rest. I looked out at the people in the seats, and they were all laughing, and looking at me with adoration. I saw Kim nervously giggling, waiting to see how I'd react. I realized that even though it was an accident, I'd made everyone happy, and I wanted to let Kim know that it was okay to laugh, so I joined in. I laughed hard. I was laughing at myself. We were all laughing together, a real laugh that went on for a while. I'm pretty sure that's why I officially became a woman that day. Not because of the dumb ancient ceremony where children are gifted bonds they can't cash until they're 25, by which time they've lost them. No, I became a woman because I turned a solemn, quiet room into a place filled with unexpected laughter. I became a woman because I did, for the first time, what I was supposed to be doing for the rest of my life. I may not have had that exact thought in the moment, but in retrospect, it is so clear to me. There are lots of firsts like this in life, little flashpoints here and there where you're unknowingly becoming a woman. And it's not the cliched shit, like when you have your first kiss or drive your first car. You become a woman the first time you stand up for yourself when they get your order wrong at a diner, or when you first realize your parents are full of shit. You become a woman the first time you get fitted for a bra and realize you've been wearing a very wrong size your whole fucking life. You become a woman the first time you fart in front of a boyfriend. The first time your heart breaks. The first time you break someone else's heart. The first time someone you love dies. The first time you lie and make yourself look bad so a friend you love can look better. And less dramatic things are meaningful too. Like the first time a guy tries to put a finger in your ass. The first time you express the reality that you don't want that finger in your ass. That you really don't want anything in your ass at all. Or to have any creative adventurous sex for that matter. That you just want to be fucked missionary sometimes and without any nonsense. You will remember all these moments later as the moments that made you the woman you are. Everyone tells you it happens when you get your first period. But really it happens when you insert your first tampon and teach your best friend to do the same. Speaking of menstrual blood, let's get back to becoming a woman in the temple. After I brought the house down by dropping the ball in my Torah portion, it was time for the rabbi to walk over and speak to me in front of everyone. Not unlike a sermon, but tailored to me. I'd been told that most people hated this kind of attention, but I thought, bring it on, let the compliments begin. Rabbi Shlomo was a tall man, and he had to reach down to put his hands on both of my shoulders. I gazed up at him and prepared to look humble. He began, "Amy." And that's the last thing I heard. His breath was so bad I literally couldn't listen to a word. It took all my strength not to pass out from the stench he was sending my way. I figured out quickly that I needed to gasp for breath while he was inhaling. He was giving me heartfelt words of wisdom, and I was doing lamas. What did he eat for breakfast, I thought, An adult diaper? A cadaver? The speech went on for hours. It was probably only 5 minutes, but when you're in the panic room of someone's dragon mouth, the clock really stops. Just as I was getting dizzy from lack of oxygen, I could tell from his body language that he was wrapping it up. Everyone applauded. I turned away, filled my lungs with fresh air, and smiled out into oblivion. It was official. I was a woman. Now I could have a short luncheon with smoked fish and bagels and take my closest friends to medieval times in New Jersey, just as God and Golda Meir intended. Camp Anchor. When I was 14, I volunteered at a camp for people with special needs. Camp Anchor is still around today. It's an amazing program that now serves more than 700 campers a year. People volunteer there because you can help those in need. It's good for your soul, and it enriches your life. I did it because the boys were doing it, and I wanted to have a soccer player's tongue in my mouth before I died. I would like to say that I went into it wanting to help others, but let's be real. I was a teenager who only cared about herself. Adolescence is full of awkwardness and insecurity for most people, but in my case, it was also full of grand delusions. Besides wanting boys to like me, I also wanted to embody all the impossible combinations. I wanted to be both beautiful and kind, smart and selfless. My mom was a teacher for the deaf, so I'd been around kids with special needs for as long as I could remember. I thought it would be easy, and I knew how to talk to these children like adults. I'd show them love and respect and be giving of myself. I pictured teaching a little girl how to swim and was already patting myself on the back for being such a great person. Saint Amy. People would line up around the block just so I'd smile at them and once in a while give them a hug like I was a Buddhist street monk, and they'd be eternally blessed. But mostly, I was excited to ride the bus and try to fit in with the cute guys. A lot of cool older boys from my high school volunteered at Camp Anchor. But I only had eyes for Tyler Chenney. He had soulful brown eyes and a mess of curly hair. He was a great soccer player, but also loved fish and the Grateful Dead. Wow, could there be any limits to how diverse this guy's interests were? I loved making Tyler laugh, which wasn't hard to do because he was a complete stoner, and his double-digit IQ wasn't what made him attractive. For most of my life, I've had the habit of being attracted to hot guys with the intelligence of a jack-o'-lantern and a distended belly. I always loved a belly. Tyler was no different. All I would have to do to make him laugh was quote the movie Tommy Boy. I knew it by heart, so he basically thought I was George Carlin. I think he's in finance now, and has a hedge fund or something else I can't understand. How come stupid people can still make money like that? I don't know what a hedge fund is. I want a hedgehog fund. They're so cute, and I think I need one. But I would probably kill it by accident. I can't even keep a plant alive. Okay, never mind. Tyler sat in front of me in Spanish class, and I'd stare at the back of his curly head trying to will him to turn around and declare his love for me. Something that never even came close to happening. But when I heard he was going to volunteer at Camp Anchor, well, guess what, Tyler Chenney? So was I. I'd saved the shit out of some kids to be close to him. On our first day at Camp Anchor, we waited for the bus to pick us up at an elementary school parking lot. I remember I'd laid out my first day of work outfit on my bed the night before. Wait until Tyler sees me in this, I thought. A Twitter blue t-shirt, my flannel plaid blue and green boxer shorts that had Penn State on them. And not even on the butt. This was a few years before the marketing geniuses decided to put their paws right on the spot where every dude's and most curious women's eyes go right away. I pulled up those shorts and did a half turn in the mirror and hoped deeply and sadly that this would be the outfit I'd be wearing when Tyler realized I could be good for him. I knew I had a long way to go, because so far I was still just the oily-faced girl whose idea of seduction was to whisper impersonations of America's favorite sweaty 300-pound male comic in his ear. But maybe camp was the place where he would see me in a new light. If I could just make myself become more his type, I thought. I tied my hair in one of those ballerina buns and took a hairdryer to my bangs. But within 10 seconds, they blew up in the summer humidity, so I bore a striking resemblance to Sammy Hagar. I sat one row away from Tyler on the bus and was already sweating through my carefully selected outfit, sticking to the green pleather seats, which were torn up and graffitied by badasses whose parents were failing. I listened to Roxette on my Walkman and tried to seem distant and interesting, like Brenda on Beverly Hills 90210. Whom I've modeled myself on for most of my life. She was the queen of the impossible combinations. She seemed to have been born with an innocence, me, yet ooze sex appeal. Totally me. And she would fit right in doing something as pure as a sing-along, but only if it ended with getting railed from behind by Dylan under the bleachers. Sweet, with a dark, dirty edge, just like 14-year-old me. Except none of that, and I'd never even been fingered and was deeply heinous-looking at the time. But I wanted so badly to make the shoe fit, to be the kind of impossible person Brenda was. Anyway, when the bus pulled up to camp, I took a break from envisioning myself as the center of attention at the Peach Pit, peeled my legs off the seat, and got off the bus. We walked to registration en masse while I was channeling, "We're gonna be a cool, fun group all summer, right, you guys? I'm one of the guys, but you have feelings for me. You will give yourself over to me around the 4th of July, right, Tyler?" type energy. As I approached the registration desk, where we were going to find out what group we were assigned to, I had only two wishes. One, that Tyler and I would be assigned to the same group, and two, that I'd get the cutest, littlest kids, the 5 to 8-year-old girls called the Junior Threes. The groups were divided by sex and age, and I'd seen the Junior Threes listed in the brochure when I was considering volunteering. I wanted to be their cool big sister who'd impact their lives forever. They were adorable, and I pictured us doing the annual talent show and laughing and hugging. I'd give them each a piggyback ride, and Tyler would say, "Wow, you must be sore. Need a massage?" And I'd say, "Sure, maybe later. I just have to make sure everyone gets a turn first, like a hero." And then I'd give him a massage and slip and fall on his penis and get pregnant and trap him and be on the first season of Teen Mom. "Senior 10," announced the elderly woman I thought was a man until she barked at me. "Excuse me?" I barked back. "You will be working with Senior 10. That is women 35 and up. There is your group," she said, pointing to a herd of ladies who looked more golden girls than little girls. I was thrown off. I didn't know there were campers older than me, I demurred. The woman who resembled my grandpa when he let his hair grow a little too long gave me an expressionless non-reply. "What a fun surprise," I said. I was a flake, and she could smell it on me. I'd come to Camp Anchor to flirt with boys and put something on my college applications, and she knew it. She saw right through my chia pet bangs into my shallow heart and frowned. She handed me my paperwork and sent me on my way. I slowly approached another volunteer, a beautiful Latina girl from a couple towns over. "Hi, I'm Carly," she said, beaming goodness. She was here for the right reasons, I thought. She was a beautiful, pure-souled girl, and I was a pug-nosed disaster. She was a Brenda with a twist, even more gorgeous, sexy, without seeming slutty and charitable on top of it all. That kind of perfection didn't yet make me furious. It just made me want to be exactly like her. Then there was Dave Mack, a gorgeous guy whom I would have immediately fallen in deep West Beverly High love with, except for the fact that I could see he'd already set his sights on Carly. Man, maybe if I'd gotten here first, I'd have gotten him, I lied to myself. But he was smart and could see that Carly was a living angel with perfect olive skin and a sweet little tush. Our group leader, Joanne, was a pretty woman with frizzy blonde hair, a pronounced Italian-looking nose, a fanny pack, and a great rack. She was the only one of us who got paid, though I can't imagine it was a lot. She was a kind, strong woman who'd been around the block with these ladies. She was no nonsense, but she'd still laugh with the rest of us when ridiculousness occurred, which was often. Every day, I'd put so much mental energy into wanting to be appealing to Tyler, or wanting to be as flawless as Carly. But the Senior 10 chicks, who I was now spending all my time with, had much better strategies. They generally didn't waste energy hiding who they were or faking who they weren't. There was Mona, who was always wearing a baseball hat and a huge muscle t-shirt with Mickey Mouse on it. She was strong and masculine, and her smile would light up a room. Mona had Down syndrome, as did her best friend Lucy, who had a short boyish haircut and knock-knock jokes for days. I almost never understood the punchlines, but she was so delighted by reciting them you couldn't help but laugh right along with her. Another camper, Debbie, was openly flirtatious and boy-crazy. She kept her hair braided perfectly so she felt pretty. Plump and youthful, she was like a Juliet looking for her Romeo. She had Down syndrome, too. Blanche had a long, thin, freckled face. She didn't mind being mean and made it clear early on that she didn't like me one bit. I respected that and stayed out of her way. No energy wasted between us faking it. Enid was schizophrenic and reminded me of Woody Allen in terms of her voice and her physical movements. She had short red hair with tight curls and was very neurotic. She'd often pace around and talk to herself. Once I nudged her to tell her it was time for lunch, and she replied, "Don't interrupt me. Can't you see I'm having a conversation?" Well, damn, she was right. I didn't let it happen again. She couldn't stomach small talk, but was kind enough to engage in some good debates with me. She was so bright that I'd forget about her ailments. Much like a stoic big sister, Enid would sometimes refuse to have anything to do with me. But other days, we were thick as thieves. By the end of the summer, I was closest with her. One sunny day, it was my job to hang with a camper named Beatrice, a sweet 60-year-old woman who spoke like Gollum from Lord of the Rings and had an even bigger crush on Dave than I did. Dave and Beatrice were sweet on each other. At all the dancing events, it was understood that no one danced with Dave but Big B. She was only 4 feet tall, but weighed about 200 pounds, and though her words were in general indeterminable, listening to her speak was a treat. She'd mumble something that sounded like it would only make sense in the Shire, and laugh wildly to herself and slap her knee. On this particular day, we had a huge game of Marco Polo planned for the campers in the pool. Nothing says summer like a game centered around a Venetian merchant sailor who may or may not have traveled through Asia in the 1200s to 1300s. I was fully prepared to win the game. I was younger and faster than my senior tens, and I knew I could dominate that pool. I was extra motivated, knowing that being in bathing suits always made the campers grabby with one another's bodies, especially mine. They thought it was funny to grab my breasts, and if one of them caught up to me, my boobs would be squeezed like lemons at a lemonade stand. Not that I don't like affection, but they grabbed hard, and I bruised like a peach. But before the game started, Joanne asked me to take Beatrice to the bathroom and wait for her while she put on her bathing suit. I brought her into the muggy bathroom, and while she was in the stall changing, I looked at myself in the foggy mirror. I didn't recognize myself. My body was in the adolescent state where I would get frequent growing pains in my legs, exactly every other day. I looked either long and lanky or chubby and potato-like. The only constant at the time was the difference in the size of my breasts. My right one was very much in the lead. The left one wouldn't catch up for years, and never fully has. The mirror got foggier as I stood and stood and waited and waited. "Beatrice?" She made a Nell-like grumble from within the stall. "Whoopee!" "Bea, what's going on, sister? Let's go, we're gonna miss the game." After several minutes, the door was flung open, and out came Beatrice, ready for the chlorine in her bathing suit and Teva sandals. There was just one problem. Her bathing suit was on backward. Her scoop-back one-piece was facing very much the wrong way, which meant that I was getting a full frontal view of what used to be Beatrice's breasts. They were long and old. At the time, I'd never seen anything hang on for dear life like this before. They looked like those fake snakes that pop out of trick cans of peanuts. Her cans were attached to her chest, and those snakes were loose, skin-colored, and almost to the floor. She looked around the bathroom anywhere but at me. I looked right at her. I was mesmerized. Here I'd been afraid of one of the campers grabbing my breasts, and now I was faced with hers. I could tell that she had absolutely no clue about the wardrobe malfunction, and she made a beeline for the door. "Whoa, whoa, whoa," I yelled, trying to block her. She knew something was off, but she was fired up about the pool. "Poo-poo," she said, meaning pool, I think. "You need to turn your suit around. It's on backward, honey." She looked at me with anger in her always red eyes. I could see she was ready to go and wasn't going to let me stop her. She was not interested in turning that suit around. It was game time. I body-blocked the exit, led her gently but forcibly back into the stall, and did what needed to be done. I took those bathing suit straps in my hands and yanked them down. It was a struggle. The suit was so tight, I had to drop down to my knees and use my body weight to get it off her. There we were, Beatrice nude, staring and blinking, and me trying to grip and pull at the spandex swimwear. My face inches away from her vagina and breasts, which at this point were very much in the same general area. Her soft, stretched-out nips rested on my sunburned shoulders while I twisted her suit around and told her to step back into it. She ignored me. She was probably daydreaming about her and Dave summering on Martha's Vineyard next year. Undeterred, I picked up her white and soft as porcelain-looking foot and placed it in one leg hole, did the same with the other leg, and then with all my might pulled that tiny suit over her pear-shaped body. I was dripping with sweat by the time we were finished, and the bathroom could have doubled as a steam room. We walked out hand in hand to the pool. Finally, someone at this camp wanted to hold my hand. I think she knew I needed it. Almost whistling, she led me to the pool, but I was too exhausted and freaked out to join the Marco Polo game. Instead, I sat on a deck chair, staring off into space without moving, as Beatrice splashed around with the other ladies. One of them probably grabbed my breast, but I felt nothing for the next 48 hours. Coming face to face with B's unmentionables wasn't even the most memorable moment in the Camp Anger bathroom. That one is reserved for Sally. She was a senior 10 who had some sort of aging disorder. Even though she was 40 years old, she had the body of a 7-year-old and the face of a much older woman. She had Peter Pan short black hair with some grays mixed in, tons of freckles, a furrowed brow, and a harsh look in her black eyes. She was very thin, spoke like a child, and always kept to herself. To get her jazzed about any group activity was beyond impossible. I remember approaching her once and mustering up some false enthusiasm, telling her, "Sally, we're going to the arts and crafts tent to make picture frames now." She stared into my eyes and looked through my soul. She didn't care. She knew I didn't care. She knew I knew she didn't care. In that moment, we nodded and made a silent contract to keep it more real with each other. One day, in the last week of camp, there was a fun hangout plan for all the volunteers at the end of the day. I was wearing cut-off denim shorts with my uniform t-shirt sleeves rolled up. I'd planned a special outfit because I had confirmed that Tyler would definitely be there. I knew because I'd asked him and all his friends 300 times. I'd noticed earlier that I was the only person not wearing Converse sneakers, like an adult. So I bought a pair that were blue and white and almost identical to Carly's. She'd noticed, and instead of being annoyed, she said, "Cool, we have the same shoes." Did this girl's perfection ever stop? Could you drop the ball just once, Carly? A queef? Something. Anything to let me know you're human and not an American Girl doll with perfect titties. By that point in the summer, I was pretty sure she and Dave were an item. They found excuses to touch each other and giggle when they were away from the pack. That night, Dave was whispering something into Carly's ear, and I was left alone with my new sneakers and socks that were too big for them, standing around a piano with the girls in the music tent, failing to learn the words to "We Didn't Start the Fire." I would have done anything to trade places with Carly. The shoes weren't cutting it. She was like Cinderella, and I was one of the stepsisters trying to force the glass slipper on my foot so the prince would marry me. Suddenly, out of nowhere, Sally tugged on my sleeve and pointed to the bathroom. She was a woman of few words, and she obviously had to go. Members of Senior 10 were always to be accompanied to the bathroom, and on this occasion, Sally designated me the lucky escort. Truth be told, I was honored that she chose me to walk her. We headed over to the bathroom together in silence. By that time, we were like co-workers. She was about 20 years older than me and had laid it on the line, "No pleasantries, bitch," which I completely appreciated. We stood in line for the cramped 4-stall bathroom where we'd stood dozens of times before, and when she was on deck, she again pulled on my sleeve, and I looked down at her. She was no more than 3 feet tall. She was gazing up at me very intensely, like she was casting a spell of some sort. "But you can't yell at one of your own campers. Are you casting a spell on me?" So instead, I asked, "What's up, Sal?" She didn't answer, and she didn't need to. I looked down at the floor and noticed there was liquid shit running down not one but both of her legs and onto her feet and onto my very new shoes. I resisted the urge to scream my way out of the bathroom and run to the nearest lake. Instead, I kept staring into her black eyes until she was finished. She seemed to want to hold eye contact in this moment, and by God, I gave that to her. After it was over, I focused on mouth breathing while I threw my Converse sneakers in the garbage. The jig was up. I would never be Carly. I put Sally in a stall and told her, "It's okay, Sally. Everything is fine." But she wasn't worried. She was kind of looking at me like, "Well, what now, skank?" And my answer to that was, "Joanne!" That's how I spent my last memorable moment at Camp Anchor, standing barefoot in human excrement calling for help. Joanne did come and bail me out, but when camp ended a few days later, I rode home alone in the back of the bus. Word had traveled that I'd been knee-deep in doo-doo, and believe it or not, people weren't falling over themselves to hang out with old shoeless shooms. I never got to spend time with other volunteers that night, and I still don't know a single line to "We Didn't Start the Fire." I never came anywhere close to making out with Tyler, or Dave. Back at school that fall, Tyler dated this unbelievably beautiful blonde named Stacy. They were our school's Brad and Angelina. Had there been a tabloid magazine about them, I would have subscribed. They kind of looked like siblings, which didn't bother me, but in retrospect, it is very creepy and also explains why I am drawn to Game of Thrones. Anyway, I got a lot more than I bargained for that summer. I didn't achieve my goal of getting the boy I liked to fall for me. I was running out of Chris Farley jokes for Tyler, and Dave barely even knew I was alive. But I got so much more than knowing that a few teenage stoners I was crushing on could get semi-hard around me. I got to spend time with the women of Senior 10. I went through war with those chicks. We did it all together. And I would be honored to be in the trenches again with any of those gals. Except for Martha, the oldest one in the group. She dressed like Marilyn Monroe and smelled like a bag of dicks left out in the sun for a year. I would still fight on her side, but I would have to be a sniper stationed far away or something. 20 years later, I still keep their faces and names in my heart. They are people, and they have feelings and bodies like everyone else. And sometimes those bodies produce a ton of poop, and you have to stand in it. And sometimes you have to scoop their boobies back into their very backward bathing suits. And they didn't give a fuck about any of that. And it made me feel the same. For a teenager like me, learning to give zero fucks was nothing short of revelatory. People often romanticize children or adults with special needs, as if they are innocent yet wise creatures who can humble us all into becoming better humans. First of all, nobody can be innocent and wise at the same time. That's another one of those impossible combinations. It's as unachievable and improbable as Brenda. Or Carly. And secondly, I'm not suggesting the ladies of Camp Anchor were either of those things in particular. But they owned their own flaws. And I'm grateful I got to meet them when I was only 14. I left camp knowing a bunch of women who weren't afraid to claim the guy they wanted to dance with. They didn't change a thing for the men they loved. They weren't ashamed of their bodily functions, and they didn't lie to themselves or others. They had no patience for small talk or false pretenses. They would laugh when they wanted to, like there was no tomorrow, and cry their eyes out when they felt like it. Basically, I had finally found my people. How I lost my virginity. I always fantasized about losing my virginity the way I think most girls envision their weddings, being surrounded by my friends and family with a clergyman present. JK, JK. But seriously, I've never been a girl who dreamed about her future wedding. Nothing about that white dress or the way I'd walk down the aisle. That was just never in my fantasy Rolodex. I'm not sure why it wasn't. But for many years, I did think about the moment I'd lose the big V. I imagined looking the man I loved right in the eyes and kissing him and smiling and intertwining our fingers and then two becoming one and the whole thing being slow and beautiful. Lots of soft whispers of love and it feeling like a levee of good feelings was breaking, orgasms and happy tears. I thought we'd both be virgins until the moment we took a deep breath and then we weren't. And then we'd cry and hold each other all night. I thought we'd laugh about what a big deal it was that we'd just finally done it. And spend the next day together holding hands and walking around in our own little world, experiencing a new kind of calm and bliss, until we could hide away again together and repeat our perfect lovemaking, and all would be right in the world. But that is not what happened. I didn't get to have that moment. About a year before it actually happened, I'd wanted to lose my virginity to a guy named Mike. He wasn't officially my boyfriend, but I was crazy about him, and we dated on and off since I was 13. At age 16, I'd felt ready. I went to my mom and my friend Christine and told them, I think I'm ready and I want to have sex with Mike. Looking back, I realized that going to your mother for a pep talk about losing your virginity in high school is odd. But I was raised with no boundaries, so at the time it felt like the thing to do. I talked to my mom a lot about sex stuff, actually. Whenever I'd have a question, my mom and I would go to Bigelow's Clam Bar and I'd ask away, all while downing a bowl of New England clam chowder. I'd make her laugh, slurping the soup up and asking obscene questions. In retrospect, obviously none of this was okay or appropriate, but it definitely helped make me who I am. During this particular sex talk, however, my mom and Christine both said, no, don't do it. You need to wait and make it special. My mom pointed out how awful I'd feel if he made out with someone else the next weekend. I thought about it and she was right. I wasn't a hardened groupie following my favorite band on the road. I was a teenager. So I listened to them and held on to my hymen for another year. Right around that time, I started dating a guy named Jeff. He was a classically handsome, popular guy. But there was something different about him, too. He was angrier than most teenage boys, and a little misunderstood. I ignored the signs that he was probably a bit unstable. Signs like when they gave him a fish fillet at McDonald's instead of a Big Mac, he became so furious that he cried. Truly lost it. Real tears of rage. Like the kind of tears guys are only supposed to get when they watch a movie that touches on their dad issues. So most movies. Isn't it funny that they say most girls have daddy issues, when really, every dude does? But this dude had daddy, mommy, doggy, and fish fillet issues. I just thought, well, he can't help it, but I understand him. I'm here for him. Even though we were both generally well-liked, when we were together, it was us versus the world. I've only recently broken my pattern of being drawn to the "you're the only one who gets me" guy, which is a bad guy to be drawn to, and it's not a coincidence.